So, as I started to say, I'm not sure there'll be enough. Well, what I want to do first is give some background on the ever-present lambda idea, and then, if there's time, expose some of the recent comparisons with data. Now, the latter, some of this, assuming that Nosepiwo is able to give her talk, it's going to overlap somewhat with her talk, but I hope you will find the results interesting enough to hear a little bit of it twice, and maybe you won't hear it twice, depending on how time goes. But, so the first part of the talk, I just want to give some conceptual background on the ever-present lambda idea, and then talk about some of the phenomenological tests, the most important ones involving the CMB. So the base, as Sumati mentioned, and I think this morning or this afternoon, or sometime, some basic hypotheses of causal sets led about 30 years ago, whatever, 1987 to 1990, something like that, to the prediction that the cosmological constant must fluctuate. And if you assume that the value of the fluctuations are set by, I'll call lambda, by this I mean the typical scale of the fluctuation of lambda would be 1 over the square root of v in Planck units, where v is some characteristic cosmological length scale, presumably, more specifically, something like the Hubble constant, which, or if you like, the age of the universe, or the effective diameter of the portion of the universe that we can see. So these are fluctuations. Now, if you assume that the expectation value of lambda is zero, I'll come back to that, then it implies that the current value of lambda, usually denoted by zero, this is an example of astronomers trying to always introduce a notation that confuses everyone else. So instead of lambda not meaning the initial value of lambda, it means the final value of lambda. So the value of lambda now should be approximately in Planck units 10 to the minus 120, which is approximately equal to current value of the Hubble constant squared. This is, as I'll describe in a bit, this is meant to be a non-local, these are the key words, a non-local and a quantum effect tracing its origin to the underlying spatial-temporal discreteness, or in other words, the atomicity of the causal set that's hypothesized to be the underlying structure of space-time. So let me emphasize, all these are crucial: non-locality, quantum mechanics, and discreteness, in a way that we'll see. And just as a side comment, I would underline this one twice, because my personal feeling is that no explanation of cosmological constant puzzle, no resolution, will come from local physics, whatever it may be. But certainly here, it's a non-local effect. Now, of course, a decade later or so, this prediction, so to speak, came true. But in any case, one did observe, initially, I suppose, the most convincing evidence was the supernova data. One observed an effective cosmological constant, dark energy, as it was dubbed, as it was nicknamed, of just that order of magnitude. But of course, just one prediction of an order of magnitude is not enough to verify any particular theory or model. One needs a more comprehensive phenomenological model that one can compare with data. And I think some combination of me and Nelsie Pio are going to describe that. What I want to do is give you the background to that, to those two models and to the prediction itself. So before doing that, let me list some of the tests to which this idea has recently been subjected. This is primarily due to Nelsie Pio and Nyayesh. The first one, this one is the one that's not. This is the supernova data. It's not yet published. This is some joint work with Shiv Sethi and Avinash Vaidya, who at the time were in Bangalore. I think Avinash has gone to California somewhere. I don't know where. So that's the supernova data. There's reasonable agreement. The CMB, sort of the gold standard of tests for any cosmological model. And then there's the sort of local measurements of the Hubble constant, the local measurements versus the, say, the CMB measurements, Hubble constant from CMB, and other things that are not local. When one says local, what you really mean is low redshift measurement observations, determinations. And by low redshift, of course, means nearby, but it also means recent. So because, of course, the redshift is just a measure of the degree of expansion or contraction of the cosmos at the time one is talking about. So high redshift means much earlier, when the cosmos was much smaller, and different kinds of data go into those two measurements. This is primarily, I believe, the local one. The small redshift is primarily supernova. And they, as we'll hear about, I'm sure, again, there's so-called tension between these two. And the question is, would any your particular phenomenological model help to resolve the tension? When people say tension, they mean disagreement at some level of statistical significance. There's a few others, I'll just list them. The BAO data, that's this baryon acoustic oscillation responsible for that curve you always see when you hear a talk on cosmology. There's the BBN, which means nucleosynthesis of light elements in the early universe. And then there's another one I won't even mention, but I think that probably Nelsie Pio will. Are you here? No, is no. By the way, how do we? How do we know if she's?
Say something.
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, where are you? Hi. Can you see? How are you? Must be nighttime now.
Please feel free to interrupt Rafa whenever he says something wrong.
Yes, that's right. So what I want to do now is review the heuristic derivation of the lambda fluctuation. I should write it here with many underlines. By a heuristic derivation, I mean that it's not, there's no established theory of quantum gravity, so we can't just do a calculation and work out what the effective cosmological constant has to be. So as you'll see in this derivation, which is very brief actually, I actually give two, but they're both very brief. As you'll see, that many aspects of the derivation are a bit obscure, but I think the outlines of the whole deduction are clear. And until such time as we have a confirmed theory, or even a good, completely viable theory, quantum gravity, that's probably the best we can do. But what I want to stress is that this deduction requires only very basic features of, on the one hand, quantum mechanics, on the other hand, gravity, and on the other hand, causal sets. So that's, I think, why we had and can continue to have some confidence in the logic, despite the many loose ends. Now, in fact, there's actually two completely separate trains of thought that lead to the same fluctuations, the same basic formula as this. Perhaps only the first one can really be called a deduction, but the second one is a train of thought. I don't know what else to call it. And I'll show them both to you. The first historically one, which I'll show second, is less compelling, but it's very closely related and led to one of the phenomenological models that has been tested. And so I want to show it to you for that reason. Also because it's kind of even easier to remember than the second historical one, which is the first one I'm going to show you. So as I said, this was the request.
Very confusing.
Never mind. I'm going to show you two. You'll see one, you'll see the other. Then I'll point out. Yes, well, I'm still talking about the past, so we're okay. I tell you about some work we did in the future, then you can start to worry. This may be the smearing of the light cones. So what are the basic features of causal sets that are important? So most of it, fortunately, Sumati has kind of covered. The elements of the causal set are to be thought of as atoms of space-time. They're related by a kind of relation of temporality, temporal succession, or ancestry, which makes them a partial order. And I was going to write this down, but I don't think I have to because Sumati has already covered them. But what I do want to write down, which I think you mentioned only briefly in the afternoon, is this idea of sequential growth for the causal set, which is a kind of idea for a dynamics for the causal set, which is completely, I won't say completely sorted out, but very well sorted out. There's a nice clean set of derivations of dynamical laws classically, but it's still up in the air, quantum mechanical. I might even say something about it next week in the next conference that was coming, but not here. But the important thing, this is the idea of causal set elements being born one at a time. I think you had a picture there of something like that. So I'll refer back to that picture. The important thing is that there's a kind of external time parameter, which Sumati stressed is gauge in a sense, but it still plays, and it's important that it's gauge, but it still plays a basic role in the definition of the growth process. And such that each tick of the clock, so to speak, a new element is born. So the idea is that, I mean, the thing to stress is that the number of causal set elements plays the role of a time parameter in the growth process. So this assumption that number should be interpreted as a kind of time, which will then be held fixed. Well, let me postpone saying that. The idea that number of elements should be interpreted as a kind of time in the causal set is one of the key inputs. The other key input is that, well, I don't know why this is the nth element. This is the total number of elements. The idea is that the number of elements corresponds to the space-time volume. That's this V here, is another key input, and that was thoroughly covered by Sumati this morning. But, and I stress here that it's, who may be some people who weren't here, I stress that this is space-time volume, not spatial volume. Because, of course, these causal set elements are meant to be atoms of space-time. So this is space-time volume. That's where this number came from.
What's the difference between the little m and the capital?
Yeah, there's no, I just happened to write little n and cap. I meant this is the nth, yeah, take them as the nth element, keep them both capital N. But this statement is not exact. Again, Sumati described, I think, that this the statement that number equals volume, the statement that the volume of a region of space-time is nothing but a reflection of the number of elements, causal set elements composing it, that statement is not exact and cannot be exact because of the Poisson sprinkling that Sumati described. So the more exact version of this is that the number is the volume plus or minus something on the order of the square root of volume. These are the Poisson fluctuations, which, as you probably know, are like the square root of n. If the, a good approximation n equals v, then I can write, instead of square root of n, I can write square root of v here. And that's how we'll be using it. So the idea is that number can be equated to volume only modulo these fluctuations. Okay, now.
I guess depending on what's fundamental, you could let v equals n plus minus.
Yes, that.
Of n or n equals v.
I could write it that way too.
So, yeah. So you treat v as the thing we have access to.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yes.
Sorry, so this is to be measured in Planck units or whatever?
Measured in fundamental units, which we would assume would be, we don't know exactly what the fundamental length scale is, but everything points to it being something around the Planckian value. And that's where this number here comes from. That's under the assumption that it that V is measured in something very close to Planck units. Okay, so having this now, I can give the background to the ever-present lambda idea. So we want to assume that there's, we must assume, if the theory is any good, that there's some effective continuum theory of quantum gravity at some level of approximation. And let's assume that is given in terms, for example, of a gravitational path integral. Now, at a deeper level, that path integral will have to be some sort of sum over causal sets, something like was briefly indicated by Sumati this afternoon. In a path integral, if you think back to quantum mechanics, in a path integral, you integrate over some trajectories, but there may be an initial time and a final time. When you do the integral, you hold the final time fixed. So the analog for this, if you accept this, if you hold the final time fixed, it means doing an integral, a sum over ultimately of causal sets, where you hold the volume, sorry, where you hold the number of elements of the causal set fixed. Now, if you hold the number of elements fixed, and we ignore the fluctuations for a moment, then it corresponds in the continuum theory to holding the volume fixed. If you do the path integral, little side note, quantum gravity with fixed V, fixed space-time volume, has a name. It's called unimodular gravity. By some strange coincidence, when I was out in the corridor, Jaume and Nina, I think, were talking about unimodular gravity. Should we take it seriously, or is it just a gauge fixing? I went to the bathroom and came back. They were still talking about unimodular gravity. So I'm actually not. That's a real acausality, I think. But I'm not going to say much about it, except implicitly, you may know that if you're in the unimodular formulation of GR, it's exactly in the end, at least classically, it's exactly equivalent to the regular GR formulation, with one difference, which is that whereas in the usual way of setting things up, the cosmological constant is an input parameter, and for each value of lambda, you have a different theory and different solutions. In unimodular gravity, it doesn't matter what you input for the cosmological constant. All solutions with any cosmological constant are solutions of the equation, and lambda comes out as a constant of integration. So this tells you that there's some connection here with unimodular gravity, with fixed volume and cosmological constant. In fact, the connection can be is quite, I mean, that's the other key thing that we're going to need. The other connection can be stated in different ways, but what we have to take away from, where did I write this? Yes. What we have to take away from however you think about quantum gravity is the strong suggestion that space-time volume is canonically conjugate to cosmological constant. This will be a key step in the derivative. And when I say it's canonically conjugate, what do I mean? Well, you could think of Q and P, momentum and position, as being canonically conjugate. An even closer analogy is between the energy and time. And I'm going to use that to argue, and I'll do that in a second, that there should be some sort of uncertainty relation, delta V, delta lambda, should be of the order of H star. So that's going to be another key input. Now, why do I say that these are canonically conjugate? There's different ways of seeing it. I'm going to show you one. Again, none of them are absolutely conclusive because, as always, we don't have the underlying quantum gravity theory, and so we don't know. But if you're familiar with the canonical, with the sense, with the time-energy uncertainty relation, I think you'll see a close analogy here. So the underlying reason why this works is actually very simple. It's just that in the gravitational action, there's, of course, the scalar curvature term, the Einstein-Hilbert action. But aside from that, if there's a cosmological constant, it's just lambda minus lambda, if you want, times the integral of the square root of minus g d4x, if we're in four dimensions. But of course, you can do this integral. This is just the volume. So it's just minus lambda times the volume. It's the fact that the cosmological constant and the space-time volume appear multiplying each other in the action that's really responsible for the statement that those are canonically conjugate quantities.
Volume defined as part of the, if the universe as a whole is infinite, is the volume somehow our horizon?
Right, so
is it changing?
So the fundamental, at a fundamental level, we don't know exactly what this is, because you'll see this is a plausibility argument. In the models, we take it to equal the volume of the past life in the phenomenological model.
It's changing with time.
Oh, it's definitely changing with time. Yeah, that's crucial. In fact, that's why it's called ever-present land.
So
because if you see here, the value of lambda now, prediction was comparable to H naught squared, which I didn't write here, but that's comparable to the matter density, the dark, basically the dark matter density now. And this will be, it'll turn out, I'll give it a little argument for it, but it'll turn, but it's verified in the models anyway, that this is always true. In order of magnitude, the fluctuations are always comparable to the ambient matter density or to the Hubble, critical density, to the Hubble knot, Hubble volume, Hubble parameter squared.
In what sense is V fixed in modular, right? What?
Well, let's not go in because I'm not going to really use.
So you.
Yeah. Well, okay. I can tell you, it's fixed in the sense that when you do, when you derive, suppose you want to derive the Einstein equations from a Lagrangian, from some x, so you have some region of space time. You have the metric in here. The usual rule would be fix the metric Dirichlet bound. More often you would use space-like boundaries, but anyway, fix doesn't much matter, but fix something on the boundary, and then, or don't even fix, or only consider, you know, variations of compact support away from the boundary. So everything is fixed near the boundary. And then require that the variation of the action should be zero. Of course, as everyone goes, if you do this, you'll just arrive at the Einstein equation. If you do this subject to V fixed, when I say V fixed, I mean here, by V, I mean precisely this integral. If you hold this integral fixed, you don't allow yourself arbitrary variations of the metric, then you will, that's equivalent to unit modular gravity. I should say, it's not the way it's always presented, but it's in fact a simpler way of thinking about what it means. And if you do that, you'll see, in fact, we could do the, it's like a one-line calculation. If you're interested, I'll do it. But we'll see what happens is that the cosmological constant comes out as a constant of integration.
It's like a Lagrange multiplier.
Lagrange multiplier just comes out.
Maybe my question is simply so that quantity, that integral that you say you keep fixed, that would increase with time.
Yes. Yes.
So how do you, in what sense is it fixed when it's increasing with time?
Fixed under.
In a variational sense, is it fixed? But it's
so
not
you, when
obviously
you vary,
fixed.
You fix, do it at some moment in time.
Yes.
Yeah.
In a certain time slice.
In fact. Yeah.
Sorry. Is it a constant, or do you get an equation of motion for lambda?
You don't get an equation of motion. If you do this unimodular gravity, it's a constant. There is a formulation of it, a kind of canonical formulation, in which it looks like a variable, but the equation of motion forces it to be constant. And that's another way, if you look into that formulation, it's another way of seeing the conjugacy between lambda. Then it becomes a pseudo-dynamical variable, and that dynamical variable is conjugate in the more traditional sense to the volume, which is, yeah, it's, they introduce some sort of form that represents the volume. When you integrate it over a surface, its value represents the volume to the past of that surface. And you make up equations of motion for that. So that's the other dynamical variable. So you don't normally think of space-time volume as a dynamic variable, but if you try hard enough, you can make it look like a variable defined at a single moment in a single hypersurface. It may be, since we've gotten so far on this, it may be worth emphasizing that the one thing, I mean, when people, this is going a little bit far afield, but it's, you inspired me to work with your question, that people often talk about the problem of time, which is a gauge fixing problem. How can we introduce some time parameter in an arbitrary history of the metric? And basically, you cannot. There is nothing that you can, within the normal geometrical formulation of gravity, there's nothing that you can see on a hypersurface that's guaranteed to always increase with time. In certain dynamic, subject to certain equations of motion, it may, but in general, there's nothing. But the one thing that always will increase with time is the volume to the past of the hypersurface. It's not a very profound statement. If you move type of surface forward, the volume to the path decreases. So it's another indication that volume is a kind of time-like parameter for gravity, natural time-like parameter for gravity. And it meshes quite nicely with the fact that number of elements is the natural time parameter for the causal sets.
So this volume is negative, right? Because of the determinant.
Oh, should I leave a minus sign on? It's imaginary.
No, I'm just...
No, it's not. It's meant to be, by definition, a positive quantity.
Okay.
There is a minus sign here in the definition of lambda. Other than that, the volume is just by definition. And it better be if causal sets are near the truth, because of course, minus three elements in the causal set is a little difficult. So let me just give you a kind of argument for the conjugate. So let's suppose, since we have the picture here anyway, let's suppose we were doing quantum gravitational path integral, and we somehow evolved to get at some time some final hypersurface. We evolved to get a three metric G, J, K, and you want to produce some sort of wave function for that. So you have some sort of psi of G, J, K. So a huge amount of quantum gravity, especially the canonical quantum gravity, focuses on this object. The Wheeler-DeWitt equation was an equation on this object, and so on. It's not, in the causal set case, it's not the most natural object. But we're trying to make an argument now in the continuum. So let's imagine that in doing this integral, we initially hold fixed the volume. By holding fixed the volume, I mean holding fixed this integral. So we sum over only metrics which have the desired value of that integral. That'll produce a wave function, which I'll call psi of v. It's really psi of v and the three metric, but just to show the lines of the argument, I'm leaving out the three metric. So I want to just focus on its dependence on the volume that we allowed for the metric. So what is this? It's formally e to the I s of g. I'll just assume a metric. You could have other matter fields, but they won't change anything. So for simplicity, I'll just write the metric. And there's some bound, I mean, this is a kind of formal description of the sort you usually see written down. So this would be the full gravitational path integral. However, we want to hold the metric, the volume fixed. So this is the integral of square root of minus g minus v. That's the parameter, the time-like parameter that we put in. This just has the effect of holding that metric to those whose associated volume equals this parameter v, right? Okay, so that's what I would call psi of v. Now, what if we do a Fourier transform on psi of v? So this will be Fourier transform, simple enough. It'll just be psi of v e to the minus I lambda v dv. Of course, I just called, this is just some parameter in the Fourier transform. I'm calling it lambda. We'll see why. So that's equal to the integral dg again, dv. Now there's a dv also. There's the delta function. Integral minus g minus v. And there's e to the I s. I s, this just means the Einstein-Hilbert action, which you might as well say with no cosmological constant. But of course, here was this Fourier transform kernel, so it's S minus lambda V. Now I can do the integral in V. Can everyone see? It's not too low. I can do the integral in V, and all it does is it just. Which symbol? This E?
The first one, on the leftmost extreme. Left extreme.
Oh, this is Fourier transform.
Oh.
It's just, I just say, we'll do a Fourier transform. We take this psi of V and we Fourier transform it to get psi of some parameter, lambda. Now you can, well, let me just finish the calculation. So when I do this integral, it'll have the effect that I replace V here by the square, by actual spacetime volume. So that'll equal the integral of dg e to the I s minus lambda times V, what am I doing? Lambda times the integral, I should make it clear. Put in the dx. And this, I'm calling this psi of lambda, which really means psi of lambda and the given three metric that you're interested in. So what have we shown? It's really a trivial calculation. What have we shown? We've shown that if you take the wave function expressed in terms of volume, spacetime volume, and do a Fourier transform on it, you will get the wave function. You will get psi of lambda. I meant to point out, of course, that this is psi of lambda. This is just doing the integral, the gravitational integral at fixed lambda instead of at fixed spacetime volume. This combination here is the full action, including cosmological constants. So the moral is that lambda and V are complex, they're quantum mechanically conjugate to each other in the same sense that any two variables that are related by a Fourier transform are canonically conjugate. If you think of momentum and position, of course, you know that a wave function expressed in terms of position is related to a wave function expressed in terms of momentum by a Fourier transform. And as I said, all we really used here was the fact that all this calculation used is the fact that in the gravitational action with cosmological constant, there's a term minus lambda V. We're here, of course, V means the integral, and V means this. So we can assume that, do I want to say more? Yeah, so let us assume then that in quantum gravity, because space-time volume and cosmological constant are conjugate, there should be some sort of uncertainty relation between in their fluctuation. So that's the first big input. Also, you can make this even more plausible by using the analogy between energy on one hand. I won't say anything more about this. Energy, if you go and look at terms like, if you look at relationships like particle mechanics, variation in the action is minus H delta T, You may know this relationship. This, of course, means energy. You see that there's actually a close analogy between energy on the one hand and cosmological constant and time on the one side and V. So we can also bring in the time-energy uncertainty relation as a kind of support for this reason. Anyway, there are many ways that you can be led to this. The important thing is this relationship. Now the other thing, therefore we, well, is this relationship. After that, all we need is to plug back in well, we have everything we need. So the two, what this tells us is that the fluctuations in the volume. Okay, so now let's review. We imagine that we're doing a sum over causal sets. We hold the number of elements fixed in the causal set. Oh, I know the thing that I was going to say. You also see here why in the unimodular theory, you get no information on the cosmological constant. Because of this relationship, if I hold V exactly fixed, like I do in the continuum unimodular theory, then that delta V is zero, right? If I hold it, that means that delta lambda has to be infinite. In other words, no information on the cosmological constant. So if I do pure unimodular gravity in the continuum, as Sumadeep also mentioned, is easily seen, cosmological constant can, you have a Lagrange multiplier associated with holding the volume fixed, and that Lagrange multiplier combines with lambda to get an effective lambda that can be any value that you want. However, we're not really in the continuum. And what we're really holding fixed is N and not V. And that means that we're really talking about a V which fluctuates. So the delta V, what this means is that the delta V is of the order of the square root of V. And if we, if delta V is not zero, that means you're effectively doing some sort of integral over a range of volumes where the range is given by this. And then as it always is with Fourier transforms, the corresponding range in lambda will be h bar over that. So to summarize, we have delta V, delta lambda is the order of h bar, or just one. I'll set h bar to be one. We have delta V, this is the order of the square root of V, again in natural units. I could write V over L naught fourth, where L naught is the basic length scale, but I'll set that also equal to one. And these two together just imply that delta lambda is of the order of one over the square root. So that's the first derivation or deduction. If, now this is only dealing with the fluctuations. As you probably have heard many times, there are really two cosmological, I mean, what does this do with the cosmological constant puzzle? There are really two cosmological constant puzzles. The first puzzle is, why is lambda zero? This is historical. First puzzle is, why is lambda zero? And then the second puzzle is, why is lambda not zero? Because if you've managed to come up with an explanation why it's zero, then you have to say, well, it's not quite zero, it's very small. The idea here is that there is some explanation for why the mean is zero, which we don't yet understand, although I may say something about it later. But if we assume that the mean is zero, then the fluctuations is all we have. And so that was the prediction, that we should see lambda about the size of the fluctuation.
I was wondering whether you want to take a break.
Well, do I want to take a break or just finish? I don't know. If I have probably 10 more minutes, I can finish. I mean, if I go through all the results and so on, then it'll be significantly longer.
Sure.
I don't know what to do. I should, however.
Yeah, I don't know. I just have to finish quickly.
I see. Why don't I just finish these arguments, the second argument, which is even much shorter. That maybe take at most 10 minutes, and then quit for today. Did I erase? Oh, here are the tests. Maybe I should, yeah. Maybe I'll say a couple of words about how the test came out. But I mean, let me finish the other argument for ever-present lambda.
We will be discussing a lot of results with this CMP and all other customers.
Yeah, maybe I'll leave this all to NoCPWO's talk.
I will talk about CMP in general. I think probably if you cover the kind of the basics in terms of causal sense, that would be, I think, all that will be good.
Let me see if there was anything in the conclusion section that I should. No, we don't need that. We don't need. Okay. Yeah. I'll just give the other argument. And then I'll jump to the conclusion. Okay. So one thing that I do want to stress here is that it's not. Oh yeah. So is it okay over here, or should I erase? Go over here. Okay. I do another sort of hand waving. This hand waving is completely borne out by the phenomenological models that implement this idea. But at the moment, you'll see it just as hand waving. So we assume, as I said, that the cosmological constant mean is zero. So when I write lambda now, I really mean the fluctuations in lambda. Now, what is V? If we want to estimate the size of lambda, this is related to the question. How does it vary with time? If we want to estimate the size of lambda, we need to estimate the size of V. The idea is that at any given cosmological epoch, the typical length scale is the Hubble scale. This is, remember, this H is roughly speaking the inverse age of the cosmos since the Big Bang. So this H inverse is basically the age of the cosmos, the characteristic length scale of the cosmos. And the volume, if we're in four dimensions, this is crucial. If we're in four dimensions, then the characteristic space-time volume will be this to the fourth. And this will imply that lambda is comparable to V to the minus 1/2. That's what we derived. That will then be comparable to the Hubble constant squared, which is what's called the critical density, which is the actual density, roughly the density of dark matter that we have today because space is roughly flat. So the result is that at any time, if you do this calculation at any moment, you're going to find that the typical value of lambda is comparable to the critical density. That's why it's called ever-present. And D equals 4 is the critical dimension. If you put a different dimensionality here, you won't. The H squared is the same in every dimension, but you won't get this piece will be, the V will be different. And so you'll find that in some dimensions, the cosmological constant tends to dominate over dark matter or matter, and in other dimensions, matter tends to dominate over the cosmological constant. So it's very, very tempting, and I don't say that I resisted the temptation, to make up a story that explains that that's why we're in four dimensions. But I won't tell the story now. But, but to save time, I won't tell it. To pique your curiosity, I won't tell it. But I'll probably have a chance to say in the next talk. So that's the end of the first argument. Let me just very briefly review the second argument, which is the one that leads to the first model, model one, what most people call model one. But I'm not doing it just to be perverse. That argument doesn't lead to model two. Model two just comes out of this. It's just a way of realizing this. However, there is one thing I have to say, which about model one. Let's think about the cosmological constant in a slightly different way that will lead to this other argument. I'm writing again the gravitational action, where V is equal to the integral. And this kappa is just the rationalized Newton's constant, 8 pi g, which is the convenient one for many reasons, but especially cosmology. Now, what is this telling us? This I can do this integral as I did before, and it's just equal to, it's just saying that this term is cosmological constant times the volume. If I divide this through by the space-time volume and ignore this term for the moment, well, forever, I get minus lambda, right? I'll put a minus. So up to sine, what this is telling us is that the cosmological constant can be just thought of as the action per unit volume of space-time. It's not the whole action because there's something coming from the curvature. I think Nosy Piwa has a nice name. She calls it the action of free space-time or the free action or something like that. It's the action that's there just because space-time is there, nothing to do with its curvature, conformal curvature, anything, gravitational waves. So that's one way of, that's just a rewriting the equation. The cosmological constant is this free action per unit volume. But now, remember, for the causal set, the volume is the number of elements. So that means, and from a causal set point of view, it's equal to the action per unit element. Now we go on a somewhat of a flight of fancy. Say, suppose, now we're doing gravity, we don't know how to do this, but each element in some sense has to be contributing something to the, if you have a cosmological constant, each element is contributing a certain amount to the action. What should it be? Well, we don't know, but on order of magnitude, suppose each element contributes plus or minus one, or let's say plus or minus h bar, if you want to put back h bar to the action. Of course, I mean just order unit plus or minus h bar. And suppose you can just add up, suppose also, it's another supposition, you can just add up the actions from all the elements to get the total action. Well, that's this integral, wherever it works. Then the total action would just be scaling like, so you have, but now we'll assume that these are independent. This is the strong assumption. Assume that these contributions are statistically independent. Well, what happens? It's like a random walk with plus one in one direction, minus one in the other direction. You know, if you take n steps in a random walk, you typically go a distance square root of n. So that would mean that the action would be typically the total action of the order square root of n, and that would imply that lambda, which we just said was the, this is the three action, divided by n, would be the square, one would be square root of n over n, or one over the square root of n, which of course we know is one over the square root of v. So this leads to the same conclusion. It's not on as firm a ground, but it does lead to the same conclusion. And it means that it gives you a way, if you think through this whole little set of derivations, you can actually mimic these in a phenomenological model, and it gives you what we call model one for how the cosmological constant fluctuates, evolve with time. That's the model one. Model two, the only reason that I want, aside from the, I thought it's nice to show this even simpler argument, but the main other reason why I wanted to refer to model one is that it shows you one other thing, which in model two is left as free, a free parameter, which is if you want to know, if you want a phenomenological model that realizes this, this basic, wherever it is, this, if you want a phenomenological model that realizes this, there are different ways of doing it, but one of the most phenomenologically important things will be this tells you what you expect the average size of the fluctuations to be at any moment of time, but how are they correlated in time? What is their correlation time? How long does it take for the fluctuations to forget what they were? And model one gives a precise answer to that, and it says that correlation time turns out to be given by what else? The Hubble scale. Model two, which is the one that most people mainly will talk about, gives that correlation time as the free parameter. And it's kind of nice that when the software finds the best fit, it does in fact give something of order the Hubble scale for the correlation time. So let me just say the one. I mean, I could ask if there are any questions, but maybe I shouldn't, since there's not really time. But now I've cleverly lost. Here we go. So I'll assume you've all seen the simulations and so on, which you haven't, but you'll see that everything works out nicely. Let me emphasize two. So the main conclusion is, yeah?
Do you think you're, yeah, okay, so.
This is like a minute. Fluctuating lambda is viable. And the second thing is, I can just say in words, it's a joke that I like to tell about this, which is that I used to say quantum gravity is batting 1,000. For those who know, not everyone will know.
What?
Batting 1,000, for those who know what it means. It's a reference to baseball, so you won't know what it means. But it also needs to be corrected. It means there's only been really one, I used to say, there's only been one prediction from quantum gravity that's been tested, sort of, and that's this prediction, and it came out true. So quantum gravity has got one for one. That's what it means, batting 1,000. But that's actually, when I thought about it more, it's actually not true. It's batting 500, which is like it came to bat twice and it struck out once. And why is it really batting 500? That's because there was an earlier prediction, which is that lambda was zero. That was a prediction that was made from the gravitational path integral by Baum and Hawking, and later greatly enhanced by Sidney Coleman. The original one said that the cosmological constant is exponentially small with an arbitrarily large, an infinite exponent. And then Sidney changed it into it's small with e to the e, e to the minus e to the some huge number. That prediction, of course, came out to be wrong. But and it's wrong because they used the wrong. Anyway, I won't say why it's wrong, but it's obviously wrong. But nevertheless, one hopes that something like that is right to give us the statement that the expectation value of lambda is zero, which would be needed in order to make this whole picture really hang together. I'll stop.
Thank you, Rafa.